All right, is this thing working? Do we still have an audio guy? We don't have an audio guy. Turning it on. Help.
Yeah, you're not supposed to mess with the controls.
Don't mess with the controls. All right, I'll just try speaking the old-fashioned way. So maybe I can even get close to the microphone. Right. Yeah, before I get started on this, since I'm the last contributed talk, it's my duty and pleasure to thank the NIST people for running this whole thing. So please join me in thanking all the NIST people. All right, as for actual content, I'm not sure that I'm going to finish in 13 minutes and 3 seconds, but I'll give it a try. This is joint work with Chao Tung, better known as Tony, who's sitting somewhere around here, I believe. Yep, we're right there. Okay, and let me start the actual content by telling you about the fantasy world that we teach to algorithms students. If you teach an algorithms course, or you've just been in an algorithms course, or you read an algorithms textbook, then what you see in that book is a whole lot of algorithms, examples of algorithms, where maybe there's some principles of designing the algorithms, but ultimately what you learn is here's an algorithm. For instance, maybe the algorithm you have in mind is, find the clicker, heap sort. And then once you've specified the algorithm, then there's some onerous but ultimately feasible task of proving that the algorithm works. So in the case of heap sort, you say, well, this is an algorithm that sorts an array. And then you prove that it sorts the array. And it takes a little bit of effort, but then you're done. And then there's something else you have to prove, which is how fast the algorithm is. And that's the third part of this pattern of analyzing algorithms, is once you've written down the algorithm, you prove it works, and then you prove its runtime, which in the case of heap sort, you prove that it takes big O of n log n comparisons, and maybe you analyze it in more detail. Now, all of the things that we teach the algorithm students about these algorithms are correct, hopefully. I mean, if you actually prove everything, then yeah, these algorithms work at the stated speeds. What they learn from this that's not true, the fantasy part of this, is that actually you can prove that algorithms work at the speeds that they seem to work at. So let's compare this fantasy world to what actually happens for real, interesting algorithms that we use in cryptanalysis. For instance, breaking elliptic curve cryptography. Now, once you have a quantum computer, then it's so fast we're not worried about it, but in the pre-quantum world, to attack elliptic curve cryptography, we say, well, we're going to use some fancy algorithm to break ECDLP. Unless somebody screws up in implementing ECC, this is the best attack we have. And then the fancy algorithms, there's some distinguished point row method. You use the negating variants, which save a factor of square root of 2. And everybody believes that these algorithms take time 0.886 square root of L on average, if L is the prime order of your elliptic curve group. At least that's what everybody says, but is it actually true? At this point, the mathematicians start saying, well, do you have a proof? And the answer is no. In fact, there's no reason to believe that this is provable. Maybe it's provable, but maybe not. So, okay, the mathematician gives up at that point, finds something else that they can prove. But wait a minute, we actually care about whether this algorithm works at the specified speed. So, does it work at the specified speed if there's no proof? Maybe actually it doesn't. For example, if you go back to the papers that introduced this type of algorithm, there weren't that many of them. One of them, by Gallant, Lambert, and Vanstone, wasn't completely defined. They weren't totally clear about what exactly they were telling you to do. And there's a few reasonable interpretations of this. And then a paper 10 years later by Boss and Kleinjung and Lenstra said, well, here's a reasonable interpretation. It's not the only one, and it's not the best one because it doesn't work. It's an algorithm that was believed to run at the 0.886 square root of L speed, but it actually just fails, basically always fails. You have to be incredibly lucky for that algorithm to ever succeed. There's another interpretation of the algorithm that does work, but this is a very plausible interpretation of what they wrote. It's something that someone could well have implemented and would have believed, based on the literature, that that interpretation does break ECDLP at that speed, but it does not break ECDLP at that speed. If you want more information about these kinds of algorithms, then some of us have a follow-up paper which is saying, okay, here's the best algorithms, here's algorithms that actually work. But wait a minute, how am I so confident that these algorithms work? Why do we believe that these algorithms work? The answer is, we've done a lot of experiments, and we've observed the algorithms working. And that's something very convincing, but that's quite different from a proof. So the fantasy world that we teach the algorithm students is that you write down an algorithm, and there's all sorts of fancy design of the algorithm, and then you prove the algorithm works at the speed that you want it to work at, and then you're done. The reality is, we don't have these proofs for, say, ECDLP, or how about factorization? For the number field sieve, it's not even obvious what the runtime is. Nobody has a precise formula for the runtime. There's nothing like the 0.886 square root of L. There's some extremely vague asymptotic, which is giving you so much room that you can't really make predictions like RSA 1024 has 2 to the 80 security. That is not what the formula says. It's nowhere near that precise. And nobody has a precise replacement for it. So the factoring statement, the theorem that you might want to prove about our best factoring algorithms, hasn't even been written down, never mind proven. And there's some drastic simplifications of those statements where for 20 years now, nobody's been able to prove ridiculously simplified versions of statements along the lines of the number field sieve works, never mind works at a particular speed. Of course, we carry out experiments and we observe it working, so then we're happy. How about code-based crypto? Finally, something post-quantum. Everything I've said before could be, well, you just apply Shor's algorithm, and Shor's algorithm is fast enough and easy enough to analyze. We know it works. But how about some post-quantum systems? We're going to switch to these, say code-based crypto. And then you look at the best algorithms for attacking code-based crypto, and we do not have proofs that these algorithms work at the speed that we say they work at. But we carry out experiments, and so we believe that they work. Lattice-based crypto. This is another case where we only have a very rough idea of how fast the algorithms are. If you try to write down a formula, it's very, very difficult to say precisely how fast the best lattice attacks are, and then we certainly can't prove these things. We just carry out a lot of experiments, and we see that, yeah, they run at a certain speed. And multivariate quadratics, the other big candidate that has shown up for doing, say, encryption. Again, there are some sort of proofs of some things, but they are not complete proofs that these algorithms work at the speeds that we say they work at. So where we get the confidence from about our attack algorithms working at the speeds that they do work at is from experiments, which causes an obvious problem if we look at quantum algorithms. So I don't have a quantum computer, and I would nevertheless like to understand how fast quantum algorithms are and write down quantum algorithms that work and not write down quantum algorithms that don't work. Some of us had a paper on subset sum. Very simple problem, but the best algorithms for attacking subset sum do not have complete proofs. They have heuristics, and in most cases you can prove something, but they do not have complete proofs that they work at the speed that we think they work at. And well, we have a paper doing a quantum version of those with a better exponent, and got a referee remark saying, how do you know that this algorithm works? Do you have a proof? Even without quantum computers, again, there's no proof. With quantum computers, there's no proof, and we can't even run the algorithm. So how do we know it works? You can't expect, given all the history of what's happened for all the pre-quantum algorithms, you can't expect that interesting cryptanalytic algorithms are going to have proofs. Maybe they're not even provable, no matter how much work we put into them. Most true things are not provable. So what do we do? How do we actually obtain confidence? One possible answer is we wait for having a quantum computer, and then we can carry out experiments. But right now, that's a slow, painful process, and even in 2031, when we have a 50% existing quantum computer, it's still going to be an expensive thing that not everybody has access to, and so we don't get to carry out experiments on it. So what do we do in the meantime to gain confidence about quantum algorithms? Well, you could say this is a familiar problem. I'm describing quantum computers as a non-existent thing and normal computers as an existing thing where we carry out experiments, but actually, it's really just a scaling problem. I mean, you can carry out experiments on a sufficiently small quantum computer, and that's just like the situation with regular computers. We haven't carried out 2 to the 80 computations that would be approximately required to break 1024-bit RSA with a pre-quantum computer. But nevertheless, we do think that NFS takes 2 to the 80 operations to break RSA 1024. The reason that we believe this is that we've carried out some smaller scale experiments and then extrapolated. And why can't we do the same thing for quantum? Well, I would say this is a not very good analogy, because in the case of pre-quantum computers, we've done some pretty big experiments. Done 2 to the 50, 2 to the 60, even 2 to the 70 computations. And it's not that much extrapolation to get up to 2 to the 80. Whereas for quantum, it's quite a challenge right now to do something with, say, 2 to the 6th qubits. 2 to the 5th, then you could say, okay, I can simulate that on a regular computer. But 2 to the 6th is pushing that beyond what we could do. And if you compare that to an interesting quantum algorithm using, say, 2 to the 80 operations on 2 to the 40 qubits, extrapolating from 2 to the single digit up to 2 to the 40 is much more room for extrapolation errors than extrapolating from 2 to the 70 up to 2 to the 80. So this analogy that says that the quantum situation is just like what we're used to, that analogy breaks down. We really have a much more serious problem trying to convince ourselves that quantum algorithms work. And that brings me to the concept of simulation. All right, what is a simulation? I'm going to spend essentially all the rest of my time just explaining the title of this talk, the trapdoor simulation of quantum algorithms. A simulation means that you're doing some sort of computer-assisted proof, some combination of a human proof and some computer calculation to the extent you can, of the performance of an algorithm for some input. Often people talk about simulation of some physics computation where, well, physics is doing some operation according to the laws of physics, and that you simulate the laws of physics, which means you have your computer plus your mental proof, which are evaluating what the physics is going to do. Here I'm interested in simulating algorithms. So we're doing a computer-assisted proof of what an algorithm will do for one input. That's what a simulation does. Now I'm emphasizing this for a particular input because that's what makes simulation easy. If you compare this to the kinds of proofs that we give in the fantasy world to our students, when you have just one input, then you actually can state a theorem saying, for this input, for the coin flips that happened in the algorithm and this particular input to the algorithm, the time taken by the algorithm is this. The output was that. There is going to be some result like that. And so you can state a theorem once you've done the simulation. The steps of doing that simulation are easy. You don't have to worry about what happens for lots of inputs. You don't need some formula that tells you what happens for every possible input. You just need to understand one input. That's what makes simulation easy. You will always have provability. There is a proof and you can find it. Also, because the steps are so easy, you often have a computer taking care of most of the steps for you, sometimes even all the steps, and then you know that your proof is correct. At least you have more confidence in the computer than you do in the human. Typically, what a simulation looks like is you have the simulation chugs along and it says at a certain moment, okay, the algorithm will now have taken, the thing we're simulating will now have taken time t1, and it has a state which is compressed, encapsulated somehow as some state s1. That's what the simulation prints out. And then it chugs along for a while and says at time t2, the algorithm state is represented by s2. And it prints out the t1, s1, t2, s2, etc. until it gets to the end and says here's the end of the algorithm. And then all you have to do is prove that this computation you've done of t1, s1, t2, s2, and so on matches the original algorithm, and you prove that one step at a time. And this is usually a very easy proof to do because, again, you just have to look at one input and match it to what your simulation is doing. An example of a simulation is an experiment. The experiment, you just run the algorithm, and then you put in some debug statements. You run your algorithm in a debugger and have it print out the time is now the end time and I've finished and here's my output. That's a special case of a simulation, which is an experiment. All right, now that I've got my terminology, what does this mean for quantum algorithms? My laptop here is not a quantum computer, not in any interesting way. I'll skip a comment about D-Wave at this point. The interesting quantum algorithms out there say Grover. I'm not going to be able to carry out a Grover experiment of any interesting size on this laptop. Would you believe me if I told you that we can carry out a Grover simulation efficiently of a big size on this laptop? Does anybody believe this? I see a few hands raised. But most of you should be objecting that this is ridiculous. I mean, I can't carry out a quantum computation on here, so obviously I also can't efficiently simulate a quantum computation. And here's the argument. Suppose that you can simulate a quantum computer on your laptop. Say, simulate Grover's algorithm on your laptop. Then, well, you should be able to actually run Grover's algorithm at that speed. I mean, you've got your computer simulating Grover's algorithm. How's that different from running Grover's algorithm? So the argument that I'm going to give you is that no, actually, it's the logic that you might be thinking there is incorrect. Just because you can simulate Grover's algorithm doesn't mean you can run it. And again, you might think, wait a minute, you just run the simulation of Grover's algorithm on the input to Grover's algorithm, and then look at the output of the simulation, and there's the output of Grover's algorithm. Sounds like good logic, but here's the logical flaw. The one thing I want you to learn from this talk is that the simulation doesn't have to take the same input as the original algorithm. And it can still be a useful simulation. For example, you can just keep thinking of Grover for the remaining few minutes. This is the concept of trapdoor simulation. So in a trapdoor simulation, you have the algorithm is taking a certain input, which is not the same as the simulation input. The simulation has some extra input, which is making the simulation easier to compute. For instance, typical example, which in some sense covers every example, the algorithm output, the original algorithm you're trying to simulate, can be some x, where x was fed through some function f that's, say, easy to compute to give you the input to the original algorithm, which is f of x. The problem solved by the original algorithm is invert this function f. This is what most algorithms do, is they're trying to invert some sort of function. Interesting algorithms. The simulation, instead of taking f of x as an input, takes x as an input. And now the logic on the previous slide breaks down because you are no longer feeding f of x to the simulation, you're feeding x to the simulation. And the simulation is not going from f of x to x, it's the simulation is going from x to x along with the s1, t1, t2, s2, and so on, which are the information that the simulation is telling you about the algorithm. So by running a simulation where the simulation has input x, and tells you what the algorithm did for input f of x and output x, the simulation is often able to efficiently run that algorithm where you wouldn't have been able from f of x to run the algorithm. Again, think of Grover. Well, what you should be imagining if you've seen a proof of Grover's algorithm is that this is exactly what happens when you prove that Grover's algorithm works. And in general, all the interesting quantum algorithms, when you prove that those algorithms work, you know something about the computation, which is your knowledge is not captured entirely by the input. In the case of Grover's algorithm, there's some output, which is telling you much more about the evolution of Grover's algorithm. What you write down in proving that an algorithm works, you write down some formula which says for the x that Grover is searching for and for the time step in Grover's algorithm, here is a formula for the state of Grover's algorithm in terms of angles of blah, blah, blah. And here's the time it takes to get to that state. And you prove that formula inductively. But having a formula for that, that's a constraint on the kinds of algorithms that you can do this for. Being able to prove a formula, even having a formula, being able to write it down, that is restricting the kinds of algorithms that you can analyze. A simulation can just say for every input x, for one input x that you're trying to simulate, for each time step, one after another, write down what the time of the original algorithm is and what the state of the original algorithm is in some compressed form. If you can do a proof, then you can do a simulation, but there's many situations where you can do a simulation without being able to do a proof. All right, so I claim that this concept of trapdoor simulation is something easier to achieve, much more broadly applicable than the concept of a proof. And we should be able to write down simulations for algorithms where we don't have proofs. And we should be able to convince ourselves that these algorithms work very efficiently, even using pre-quantum computers. We should be able to prove that post-quantum algorithms work. Now, at the moment, my last slide here is not for algorithms where we don't have proofs, but, well, okay, let me tell you exactly what the situation is. So Tony did an implementation for Umbinus's distinctness algorithm. And then sent email to Umbinus saying, you know, your supposedly proven algorithm, actually your proof has a mistake. And where you say the state is this, it's not. And Umbinus wrote back and said, oops, and next day updated his paper, and okay, so now the proof is correct. This is an example where it's a provable algorithm. The proof that was written down was wrong. It's not as nice as an example as having an algorithm where it wasn't proven at all, but it's an example of the simulation actually does work and tells us something where it's easier to do the simulation than to do the proof, which is why the simulation was correct and the proof was not. One more example, also for distinctness. Tony also sent email to Childs saying, your distinctness algorithm on the archive from 2003 refining Umbinus's algorithm to have success probability 1 instead of just constant positive success probability, actually, your algorithm has success probability 0. Well, it approaches 0 exponentially quickly. You need to tweak the algorithm as follows. And this is another example of an algorithm that was wrong being caught by the simulation. It's a provable algorithm. The response from Childs was, yeah, okay, we knew about that in 2005. We fixed it in the journal version. It was just a typo. We wrote pi over 2, should have written pi over 4. But it's proof of concept. This, I think, says that, yes, we can actually usefully run simulations of quantum algorithms and get information out of those where, well, hopefully the next step is simulating some algorithms where we don't have proofs and we nevertheless believe the simulations. That's it. Thank you for your attention.
So distinctness or search, these have very compressible quantum states, the amplitudes, I mean, just by that. So here's one big one, everything else is uniform. I can write that down really simply. But what are some other ones you think that you can do interesting simulations on? Could you do a nested quantum walk search, like your subset sum algorithm?
Yeah, so nested should still be doable. I mean, even distinctness, you've got more than just, you know, Grover, you've got like one unique amplitude and then all the others. For distinctness already, for interesting distinctness computations, you get up to a polynomial number of different amplitudes. If you wanted to do something like Shor, then, well, you have to not just say it's a certain feasible number of amplitudes, but you get like the shape of the state at each moment. One target that we've identified is Belov's algorithm, which is it's sort of in the distinctness direction. It's a fancier quantum walk, which does not have a proof. It has a proof for most of the algorithm, but not the setup. And that one should be simulatable, but, well, it's a fairly complicated algorithm. It'll take a little more work than this proof of concept.
You're mentioning that there's a couple of simulations easier to implement than real simulation, but isn't it also easy to abuse it from the point of view that Yuan Diamond is saying no one key attacks on AS. Your trapper can be so much leading the simulation such that basically you prove whatever you want to prove.
That's right, yeah. So you need to, when you're looking at the information provided to the simulation, if it looks like some X where you could just look at the X and say, oh yeah, of course, that's the output that the algorithm was given, then you're not cheating and you're not getting any extra input to the simulation. But if you went beyond this and the original algorithm output was something and then you're giving a lot of help to the simulation, then you have to be very careful in articulating what it is that you're proving with the simulation. And of course, if the simulation is completely computer verified, then you have more confidence in it. If you have some computer verified parts and some human verified parts, then, well, you have to watch out for what the human verified parts are doing. Even the computer verified parts, you have to be very careful what exactly you're proving there. So you do have to be very careful with the statements that you get out of simulation. But the point that I'm making is that simulation is something which is more broadly applicable for whatever computer power you have. You can simulate more things than just the things you can compute. And you can still get interesting information out of this and more reliable information than you would get out of, even in the cases where you can prove things, but also in cases where you can't prove things, then this is really the only approach that we have to get information about the algorithm performed.
So I think we'd better wrap up, but let's see.